And so our first guest of our first episode, this man is an elite trainer. He's an author. He's a father. He is one of the voices of basketball. I'm sure you've heard or seen some of his content. He constantly speaks the truth. One of my good friends now, I like to say, Mr. Dorian Lee,
man, my brother. I appreciate you for having me, my man.
No, absolutely. So I'm glad excited. We did make it happen, man.
So excited.
No, absolutely, man.
That's my man right here, for real.
Yeah, man. Me and Dorian got connected working on basketball things together.
Absolutely.
And, man, we connected beyond what we could dream and have a similar mindset when it comes to educating people about this game of basketball.
He's my organized alter ego. That's who it is. So I love, man, he's detailed, able to put stuff in a format that kind of conveys what we want to do. Whenever it's an idea, he does it and he puts it together. So, you know, much respect to you, man.
No, I appreciate it, man. I just found out, man, looking at some of your stuff, like, I'm writing books today that you wrote 10 years ago, so man, I'm playing catch up.
You got a good one coming, too. Yours is good. Folks, y'all need to get it once it's released. But, yeah, man, we think alike. We've had so many conversations that you're funny. You're like me. You're like, matter of fact, you'll pull up the computer. You're like, I'm just like, dude, wow. Yeah. All right, so we're thinking alike, man. So I love that, man. I love that type of synergy we have when we get together, man. And we can just, it's like a kid. Like, you're so excited about something. Man, look, you know, man, Todd, look at this. And you're like, nah, man, check this out. So it's always good to have that type of camaraderie when you're trying to build something. We got some big stuff coming, so, you know, we got to build it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Man, the first question we always love to ask is, when did you fall in love with basketball?
8 years old. So I actually just did a post, the irony of it, a post about Sanaa Lathan, and when she said, you know, I fell in love at 11 and the shit just won't go away. And that's how I feel. Like, it was 8 years old. My mom put the ball in my hand. I don't remember a lot from that particular season of basketball. But the following year, I definitely just remember, like, man, I really like this, you know. And it's probably because I was good at it. You're gonna like stuff you're good at. I don't remember that first year because I know I wasn't good at that time. But I was pretty good relative to the time, relative to the level of competition. But I've always been athletic, so I've been able to, you know, grab a ball and run by people my whole life. And, you know, it's got me to the point where I hadn't ever separated from the game for any length of time. So, you know, I guess the longest I've ever been away from the game is the 6 short years I spent in corporate America. But literally my entire life has been around this game of basketball, almost my entire life.
Man, that's awesome, man. You said your mom put the ball in your hands. What was the purpose that she originally put that ball in
your hands? Because my mom was a physical ed teacher. So my mom was into athletics. She ran for Evelyn Lewis, who is Carl Lewis's mom, at Alabama State in the 50s. My mom was a multi-sport athlete then, played basketball, ran track, and was a tomboy. So growing up, she was always athletic. And the crazy thing about it, she's really one of the most beautiful women. So she was beautiful, was the best athlete, smartest student. So she was really good, but she always wanted us to play sports. My older brother played football at Alabama State, ironically. My sister played volleyball in high school, and I really was the one that took to the athletics, and really that became my life. And I'm gonna be honest with you, I don't know of a time in my life where that wasn't really my primary focus. I just have always loved the game, just everything about it.
Oh, that's amazing, man. It's amazing how this ball can take you through a journey.
Everyone, man.
Just bring you to moments in your life and you can reflect back and everything is attached to that one thing.
Absolutely, man. And that's that. You know, that's why you always have to catch yourself when you're doing all of this. Man, if I had just done this, or if I had gone here, or if I had chosen Western Carolina over North Florida, this would have happened. The butterfly effect, everything changes. That means you don't have the kids you have. You don't have the relationships. I'm not sitting here. We're in an alternative universe.
Yeah.
Right. And we never get to experience this. So I always ask myself, like, it's, you know, was it worth it? And, you know, it's times that I've questioned, all right, is it really worth it? Right. But when you start to look at the lives you've impacted and the lives that would have undoubtedly been changed had you not been involved with those kids. You start to just say, you know what, man, this was your purpose. This is what you were supposed to be doing. And like I said at my dad's funeral, you know, life is so infinitesimally small and short that it can't be about us. If it was about us, this would be such a sad existence. You know, you're going to be here 80 years, 70 years, 75, whatever, and that's it. What did you leave that continues to go? And that's the part about, you know, it's a old phrase that a teacher's impact is reverberated through eternity. So literally someone taught someone something that they taught to someone else that got to my dad, that taught to me, and I taught to my son, and it's going to keep going. And that's a powerful, powerful way to look at life, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's it. So, you know, basketball has been a ministry. You know, it's been a love affair. And when we say love affair, you know, I think people look at love as continual bliss, you know, euphoria. I disagree. I just think, you know, it's times that you don't like what you love. Mm. And it's been times I haven't liked the basketball. I think my failure, you know, and most people would look at it as not as a failure, but my failure not to play, you know, in the NBA, which was a goal. It took me a while. It took me almost till I was 32, 33 to realize that, man, you know, you're going to lay your head in this earth, never accomplishing the one thing you really set out to accomplish. And then when I started putting kids in the league, it started to feel even better. Like, man, it would have been great for me, but man, to see kids have the direction and someone who can steer them in the right direction, man, I think I'm more satisfied with that than I ever would have been playing professionally.
100%, 100%. I always look at that as like, man, I train NBA players, and so I feel like I'm there. I get to guard them.
Absolutely.
I get those opportunities to feel like I'm a part of this thing where, you know, that is the pinnacle. And yes, would I actually like my name called to play on the NBA court?
Man, of course.
All of us do.
Of course.
To be able to strive, to grind, to have purpose in this space and still impact people who are connected to it. Like you said, it's even more fulfilling.
Yeah, for sure.
To drive
sure,
other people to their purpose. So,
for me.
Man, this part is this 2-minute drill. Okay, your basketball journey from that 8-year-old moment to the day you hung them up as far as being a player. 2-minute drill of your youth to AAU, if you had it high school and all.
Can we pull this off? All right, so let's start 8 to what's 7th grade? 13? Mm-hmm. 8 to 13. Prodigy, private school, you know, if we had 38 points in the game, I had 35 of them, right? That was just that period of time, private school. Was only 5'3 by the time I entered eighth grade, so I was small. So I was 5'9 by the time I exited eighth grade, but I was little. So I didn't go out for the team, I did, but I knew I was going to get cut, so I quit. And in my ninth grade year, went out for the team, felt I was going to get cut, and quit. And then the summer between my ninth and 10th, I came back as one of the best players at my school in one year. And that's when I really understood that, man, you can really get better quickly. A good friend of mine, Harold McReynolds, always said, man, it takes one summer to change your life. And it did. And I thought I should have been on varsity. Played JV that year. Really good JV team. Then went to varsity, had my first knee surgery my junior year, so only played a portion of the season, and the confidence wasn't there. And it really, I should have stayed out a little bit longer. I should have waited to come back. But I was so arrogant, man. I was so cocky. I knew I could play, and I wanted to rush out, and I just wasn't physically ready. I needed more time. And it took a year. It cost me my confidence my junior year. Senior year, came back, and I was second in the city in scoring behind Antonio Lang, who was Grant Hill's roommate at Duke, 2-time national champion, senior year, national runner-up, had one of the most historic college careers, you know, with Leitner and Hurley and Grant. It was just a great run for him. He's a good friend of mine. But, yeah, that was it, and I had zero offers. So with two surgeries, because I had another follow-up surgery after the season was over.
What kind of injury was it?
I had a osteochondritis dissecans, which is a defect in the cartilage, can be congenital, but mine was through injury. So, and I hate telling this story because it's the dumbest story. My boys sit there and laughed at me one day for saying it, but somebody bet me to jump off of a truck while it was moving. I jumped. And I damaged my knee, and I played a whole season JV with it. And I went to the doctor for the physical before my junior year thinking, you know, I'm still jumping, dunking, doing everything. But he was just like, there's some swelling still in this knee. Like, what happened? And I knew it was that, but I was like, oh, man, we're good. And he said, no, I'm gonna schedule you to see an orthopedic doctor. And I got the schedule on, scheduled to go on maybe a Monday. Wednesday, I was in surgery, my first surgery. And man, it was cartilage damage. And, you know, once you start having the cartilage issues, it's degenerative. They did some stuff, microfracture surgery, kind of the predecessor, never heal. So anyway, no offers. Ended up signing with the National Guard. I was gonna go in, and anybody knows anything about me, I'm telling y'all, anybody who's watching this that knows me knows good and well, I would have been AWOL or I would have been kicked out in less than a week and a half. So I finally said, you know what, I'm gonna call, and it pained me. I called the local junior college, Bishop State, and because I wasn't trying out. I had schools that had, they wanted me to walk on, come, and I was like, walk on? I was like, bro, stop. And I called Bishop State, the laughing stock JUCO. Like, it was like, we roasted people. Like, you're going to Bishop. And I called, and Coach was like, man, you'll be willing to go here? I was like, Coach, I don't have anything. He said, man, I'll sign you on crutches. I was on crutches. He signed me. And, man, best decision I ever made. 14 and a half points my freshman year, 19 and a half my second year, high game of 43 in the state, multiple division win offers, Western Carolina, Southeast Louisiana, McNeese State, South Alabama at the time. Man, I had some good stuff, University of North Florida, some NAIA schools, Spring Hill, Georgia Southwestern. And it just showed, man, that, the work could pay off, and taking those chances too. So North Florida, junior year, led the team in scoring. Got into it my senior year with the coach, transferred back to Spring Hill College.
Got into it?
Yeah, got into it. I just, long story. This is a long one. But yeah, got into it with the coach. Didn't like kind of the way that he spoke with some of the players. I took exception to it. He, spoke to me in a kind of way that I was just like, I wasn't having it. And it caused friction. So, the vice president of the school mediated it. It was a big deal. I was the best player on the team, beloved by faculty, my professors. I was really popular. And I set out, man. I chose to sit out that year, and it was tough, man. It was one of those that emotionally I can really, good friend of mine, Mike Finley, can attest to it. I mean, I literally cried almost every night about that. It was just that painful. I was so good that year. Like, I was so ready, and for it to fall apart was tough. And so I ended up transferring back to Spring Hill. We were really, really good, NAIA school, but we were number four in the country, loaded with talent, had a great, winning season for the first time since that JV season. All the rest was losing years, and I learned, it was years. I wanted to be a winner. I knew I had what it took to be a winner. I just didn't know how to win. And so it took me all the way to my last year in college to really understand that. And then I went down on professional tours in Mexico, and then years later went on a professional tour in Austria. And at 31 was offered contracts, German teams, Lithuanian teams, Austrian teams. But by the end of the summer, they all kind of fell through. And the same thing was like, man, for the same price, we could get players who are younger or whatever. But yeah. I was still super athletic, averaged like 30 for the tour. It was a really, really good tour. And I came back and I started training. So that's about 4.5 minutes. But yeah, that's the 2 minute, 4.5 minute.
More like 12, but it's all good. The whole point was for you to flow through it. And so we can understand that plane journey, man. And you had a lot of obstacles, man, moments where you had to be mentally tough.
Yeah, mostly self-imposed. The one thing that I can reflect on right now is, would I had done the same thing at North Florida? I cost myself a lot of money, man. I played one game, my senior year, we played the Brazilian national team. It's a group of professional players that came to play, kind of like athletes in action. Had, you know, 24-6, 24-7. We were poised. We had a really, really good guard named Brian Sitter, another one, Bobby Patton, transfer from Stanford, won a transfer from New Mexico State. And we were the three guard front. And it was, I just always think about truly what could have been with that particular season. It could have been insane. I mean, but it never happened.
Navigating that moment or that interaction with the coach that caused for that to happen, if your son was in that situation now, what kind of advice would you give him?
Man, that's the crazy thing, because I'm such a principal guy.
Yeah.
I would give him, I would advise, I would talk to him, but I would give him the insight of the ramifications of your decision. Sometimes you stand on principle, but no one stands with you. And the irony of it is I stood with a lot of players on different issues during the season. I was never, you know my personality, I'm outspoken, I'm direct. And if, you know, we had a point guard who couldn't make their times, and I was just like, Coach, I give two rat's asses if he can make his time, bro. He can play. Just scratch the times, bro. We good. Like, I was always standing up, and it was like, you don't play until you make the time type of stuff. But nobody stood for me when it was my time. And one of the emotional moments of this ordeal, so I have to be cool not to get upset about it, but, you know, the Filipino student body hung murals at the gym during that season, and they had my number on it. So it was tough watching during that time. So
yeah,
but you know, it is what it is, man. You live, you learn, and I think I would have I would have just thought bigger picture at the time.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Yeah.
Man, it's cool that thank you for sharing and letting us in on the inside of that, man, because I'm sure, especially with today's landscape, right, there's a lot of that happening with the coaches and the players and disagreeing. Yeah. And I just had a player who was at a high major school. The coach didn't even talk to him postseason if he's staying,
so you know
if he's going.
You know,
and so he was just like, man, just come let me know so I can enter the portal or not. No conversation, and he ended up going and signing somewhere else, somewhere who's been recruiting him since he was in high school. Wow. And working out. But those moments, though, right, I think not only the kids, but the families and the parents need mentors, right?
Yeah,
during that time, you know? And so understanding that you going through it, and man, he's very easily accessible, too. he will answer your messages and get back to you. So, like, if you need some advice through that, man.
Yeah,
like,
no,
I'm
an open book,
right?
Man. You know, it's so funny. I hope you can attest to it. Like, people always say, like, man, God, you act like you do online. I was like, yeah.
Oh,
like,
no, yeah, he's real.
Yeah, like for real. It's like, for me, you know, I think being performative is difficult to sustain. I just don't think you can sustain being a personality.
Yeah.
Right. I think it has long-term consequences and detrimental effects to the psyche, to, you know, really to yourself, like, you know, your identity, like, who am I really? Or am I just on? I always talk about, like, being on, and I want people to, you know, the seed, man, I'm not on. I crack verbs. I talk Southern drawl at times. I got it all. But, you know, I can mix it up. But yeah, man, I'm accessible. People can talk to me. They can call me. And by no means do I feel like I shouldn't be accessible. You know what I mean? I think that's part of servitude. You have to be accessible. Now, you got to be judicious with where you place your energy, but the accessibility should be there. You understand what I'm saying? So that's my thought process.
Accessibility with boundaries, absolutely.
Yeah, that's for me, that's what I think.
No, that's amazing. So you said you went on some professional tours, and then you said you started training. So you just stumbled into training one day.
No, man, I tell the story all the time. So Jay's my dude, Jay Hernandez, assistant coach with the Brooklyn Nets. And man, I always give him his flowers. Because when I went on that tour, that's when I was leaving corporate America. I was a pharmaceutical rep. So I was dating a young lady at the time who we went to this wedding in Boston by, you know, a friend of hers. I don't know how she even met the friend. It was nobody she grew up with, but it's maybe a friend of a friend. So they invited him up for the wedding. I went with him. And we happened to sit at the same wedding table as Jay Hernandez. This is how we met. Now, that young lady, you know, of course I did marry, whatever the case may be. And you always ask, like, man, what's the only reason I was actually with her was to meet him? And man, we hit it off. We talked about it. And I told him, he was talking about he played at Hofstra. And I was laughing. I was like, because when you look at Jay, you're just like, eh. Killer. Like, when I tell you, baller. Part of that Hofstra Hall of Fame team with Speedy Claxton, Norm Richardson. You know, these guys, man. Jay Wright's first team, his NCAA team, was with Hofstra. That was Jay Wright, Villanova great. And Jay was one of those dudes. And so he was like, man, I train. And I was like, you ought to come up and work out before you go to Austria. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I work out. And he was like, no, man, like, you know, skill work. And I was like, literally, I'm from football country. It was like, either your dad could hoop or he couldn't. Either you figured it out or you didn't. It wasn't no like, okay, well, I can go pay money and whatever. And so, man, I was like, he showed me in 1 week just from an individual standpoint. And he was in his infancy at that time. He was good, but nowhere close to where he was. It was just basic stuff he was showing. But I was just like, damn, man, if I had some of this stuff when I was playing, I could have really, really been good. And I did the best I could. And, man, it was really good. I went over, had the killer tour. And so when the contracts fell through that summer, I was like, you know what? Damn, I could set up this training. I could do this. So that was the inspiration. And the irony of it is he was training and he was doing really well kind of on the side. But I was the first to actually start the business. And, you know, I think it kind of showed him too, like, you know what? I'm gonna step out on this thing and do it. And for the next 14, 15 years until he went to the NBA, we did camps in New York and Atlanta, like literally exclusively. That was my partner in crime. Some of the greatest video footage, man. Y'all can go on YouTube, was our camps, man. Just our patty cakes, the way we,
what was the name of these camps? So
we can look them up. The Pro Guard camp. We changed it a couple times. The Pro Guard camp, it was Pro Guard Camp 2.0, it was the Guard Development College, Hoop University. We had a bunch of different names for it, but it was some real stuff, man. It was like high level. We had some great players that came through both in New York and in Atlanta. And man, I tell you, I learned from Jay, right? And I feel I can honestly say, it's hard to speak for him, but I feel like we impacted each other's business in a really great way. Every year he came to a clinic, he was a better trainer. Conversely, because I knew he was coming back as a better trainer, I was a better trainer.
Yeah.
And probably because he knew I was going to come back as a better trainer, he came back as a better trainer. And I remember those moments, man, and we just kept pushing, you know, pushing the envelope on certain things. And now those things are now staples. Patty cakes, where people do the hand claps. Very few people know where that comes from. It comes from me. I created those years ago, and Jay took it, added some stuff to it. I saw it. I added some stuff. He saw it. He added some more stuff, and we just kept elevating it. So now it really is a standard. If you watch player development, it's almost a standard inside, and that's sometimes when you realize the impact. And I remember when I went to Japan, and I went for about a week and a half back in 2011. And when I left, I started seeing viral clips of entire gyms doing the patty cakes, man.
That was my dribbling drills for sure.
I was like, wow, man. So very few people, that's the little trivia. Nobody will ever know, but yeah, I can't.
They will now.
Yeah, and then what really set them off, Jay and Kimba did an incredible set in the middle of an Under Armour commercial back in the day. That's what really triggered everyone. They saw and Jay killed it. Jay got the swag. He killed it. And it was dope, man. So that was like what really shot it off. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What's very unique about your training is your approach, how you think about training. And I'm sure it's been developed over the years from those early days, right? Whereas, hey, we're teaching this to you being as relevant as you are today as you were then, right? Yeah. What is basketball development to you today in 2025?
Man, this is, damn, Ty, you, man, bro, you you really going deep, bro. You there's some good questions.
Thank you, I guess.
Who helped you with these questions? Did you come up with these?
I'm like literally just thinking of them sitting here.
I have a gift. That's a great one, man. For me, again, when I say for me, number one, basketball is the most disrespected sport in the world. Mm. There is no other sport more disrespected than basketball. Basketball, because of the accessibility, because people have hung up hoops in the backyard and have coached and played at a variety of levels, everybody feels like they can teach it, they can coach it, and they can play it. You don't have the same type of nonsense with golf or tennis, right, or lacrosse. And nobody just says, I'm going to be able to hit a 98-mile-per-hour fastball. But everybody thinks they can hoop. So what I wanted to lend to this space was credibility, right? I have a science background. I was a professional. I was in corporate America. I did network marketing at a very high level, so I understood approach and fear of loss and how we can, you know, put our business in a different space that made people have to respect the organization, having business cards. I'm one of the first in Atlanta, I promise you, with even the logo on my shirt. Most people were just in the gym training. So back then, I'm gonna be honest with you, Todd, it was one full-time trainer in Atlanta, and it was me. Like full-time, that did nothing else, that didn't like coach on the side or got money here or whatever. I was the first to really say, man, I can do
it. What years was this?
This was 2002.
I started the company in 2003. Okay.
So that's when I started the company, set up the LLC Basketball 101, and that was it, man. So for me today, the space, you know, so for me, because I know they came in. So for me, the space is really one of those that is I hate to use the term saturated, because I think saturation is relative. You understand what I'm saying? I think it doesn't necessarily mean that it's too many quality trainers, but it's a lot of trainers. So now, because unfortunately, and it's not to offend anybody who's listening, basketball consumers are probably the most unsophisticated consumers of all consumers. So they really don't know what they're looking for, right? Or they think they know what they're looking for and really don't know what they're looking for. So part of our journey as player development coaches, and what I see even more of, is that the education piece is really, really big. And the craziest shift is the amount of time now that kids have to train. Back then, I could get them in the gym 3-4 times a week like it was nothing. Now, it gets more and more difficult. They got this, they got this. They want to do speed and agility. They got this, they got this, they got this, they got this. The homework. It just seems like things are getting busier for kids, right? And, you know, it's a tough one. You oftentimes have to be singularly focused, and if you can't be that, it's going to be a tough ascension inside of the game. So for me, I look at it as it's a lot of activity in player development, but not always a lot of substance right now in player development. So it's a lot of activity, and I applaud. What I want to make sure I do is laud anybody who is truly attempting to help kids. But I will say, if you're going to help kids, you got to help yourself, and it's a smorgasbord of resources that you can tap into to go to that next level. So not being equipped as a player development coach, it shouldn't even be a thing, right? It's enough resources so that doesn't have to actually be a thing. So
no, 100%. I think that's my biggest gripe with trainers, is that you can go into YouTube and listen to at least college coaches or NBA coaches teach the aspects of the game. You can go and see your stuff. You go and see, I can go on Phil's stuff. You can see a bunch of stuff online for free. Not even talking about the paid stuff that actually goes in depth about how to teach it and movements
methodology
and all that. Yep. And it's like that's where the game has to elevate to, where one, like you said, kids have to stop being so busy. I'm thinking about it the opposite way. I think these parents are putting too much pressure on these kids to perform in multiple areas and confusing them. Man, I just remember growing up, we came home, we did our homework, we had time to play outside.
Absolutely.
We had time to watch TV for an hour if my mama let me, and I had time to go to practice.
You know where, all right, so I'm gonna tell you, I think commute traffic has changed considerably in major cities. You're in LA, I'm in Atlanta, so we got first cousin traffic.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? They're the same. And so the time in the car, and I'm a proponent, and this is gonna be controversial, but I'm a proponent of just everybody homeschooling, even though they go to a school, that everything is online. They meet maybe 2 days a week at school. But I don't know, and I think it's a lot of science behind this too in terms of learning. You can look at Ron Clark Academy and the way they learn, and it's, you know, and I don't know if you've heard of Ron Clark, but he was this teacher who, I think years ago, he's been featured on Oprah, but years ago, if the story's correct, he just grabbed up some regular inner city kids and he said, you know, getting to Harvard isn't that hard, and I'm gonna show them exactly what they had to do, and he got them all accepted. So he's the guy, if you ever look at some of the stuff online, he dances on table, they're rapping to learn songs and stuff, but it's a great academy in Atlanta, RCA, Ron Clark Academy, that's phenomenal. But I think we have to change the way we look at education. I think education is no longer the education of old. I think it needs to be a more interactive, a more attention grabbing, because you are fighting with the attention spans of, you know, addicted phone users. And I think it's very difficult to go an 8-hour day sitting down, you know, trying to focus on something without it being substantially interactive for them to be able to kind of fend off the dozing off throughout the day. So I think that's a big part of this. I think education, I think traffic, the fact that the day is just extended much longer affects all of this. So I'm a proponent of taking school at least 2 or 3 days out the week.
Yeah.
To the house. You know what I'm saying? I don't see any problem with that, but you know.
No, I mean, we have to unindustrialize education.
Thank
right?
you.
Education was built for the industrial age.
Yep.
And we're in the AI age.
That's a great point.
And so
man.
There's academies like probably the Ron Clark Academy that you're talking about. There's something called the Alpha School where they literally, you do school for 2 hours a day. You're still at school the rest of the day. You're still at school for 7 hours, but the rest of the day, you're learning how life skills. You're learning how to run a business.
Absolutely.
You're learning how to put furniture together. Yes, but you're doing all these other things that the skills that you need to actually build a life that isn't controlled by a company or an entity. Not even technology, because I think technology is a tool, right?
Yep.
Once we start getting influenced and used by technology, that's on the parents to me. You got to take that phone away. You got to take the iPad away. You got to show them life without them being entertained by this. How do you use this though?
Let me tell you, I think that enters into a conversation that you and I have had offline that now is about to go online. The conversation has been about making sure that the parents, whether they're together or apart, are truly on the same page in terms of raising their kids. Part of the issue is, and this is, and you know how I am about therapy speak. I have major issues with, you know, using terms of narcissism and narcissistic personality and this and that and trauma and healing journey. Now, people are gonna always say like, come on, D, that stuff is real. No, I think we identify now. I think it gives people cause is to talk about their trauma. We all had things that happened in our lives. I don't know if they're necessarily trauma or they're just life. You know what I'm saying? I think life, we have this idea that life is supposed to be just all incline. It's just going to get happier and happier and happier, but you're going to have some dips. It's going to be moments. It's going to be seasons. And I think we have issues with that. And so we have different schools of thought. And the schools of thought usually comes from how you were reared. Most people don't reflect. They don't reflect on their parents' upbringing to understand why their parents were the way they were. They just blame their parents for certain things, or this is what I would have liked or whatever. Well, you're a gainfully employed person who has not been in any trouble. You've done great things. So did they actually rear you wrong? Mm-hmm. Like, if you think about it, like, and then we got kids now that we are giving everything to and are substantially less driven, you know, more entitled, more ungrateful than they've ever been. And I know people are going to say, oh, every generation is the same. No, we all have that tendency. That's the nature of being, youth, you being young, youth is wasted on the young. But, that's something that I think has been exacerbated by technology. When you see, oh, this is how the other kid lives. His mom bought him this. And it's not even life. I think as adults, we're acting like grown kids now. We see the love relationships. I got folks who I know online. When I tell you, popular, big followings, love each other, kiss the door, hate each other in real life.
Doing it for the gram.
I promise you, I'm not joking. This is the man on a stack of Bibles, and you just like, wow, man, this the presentation is good, but the presentation is a story or a narrative that's put out there. And I think when parents are together, parents need to really make it about the kids, not the resentment or whatever, but make it about the kids and do the best for the kids as possible. So
100%. That is something that I've been a part of just in my 10 years with my program. A lot of families with co-parenting situations, yes, and bonus moms, bonus dads, stepbrothers, half brothers, half sisters, like, and those dynamics are tough. So important to acknowledge right away. It's something I ask right away. Say, hey, what's the family dynamic here?
And absolutely. Smart.
Where you guys at? I need both parents to be engaged in this and have the same plan. And let's talk about what the goal is. If the overall goal is to get them to college, these things in between about who the trainer is and how often they should be doing this or standing on a good basketball situation versus one that's not, those are the things where I have to come in and mediate the situation, and it's been great. Sometimes I've even helped marriages in those ways by helping the kid. But like, hey man, like, there's a way we could talk about this. I know y'all are not together for a reason, but there's a way to talk about this that focuses on this kid.
Yeah, and when you, one of the things that I got a truckload of kids. So having a truckload of kids always gives you a different perspective. Different mothers and different temperaments and, feelings about me and maybe whatever. But ultimately, I need to say this with great clarity. Kids don't come first in life, right? I know it's a tough one for people to digest, but just like if you're on an airplane and it starts going down, what are you gonna do? You gotta get your oxygen mask on before you help anybody or go around the cabin. In life, we have to take care of ourselves in order to take care of those kids. But what happens is, a lot of time, because of the lack within from one of the parents turn the kids into idols that they now worship, so they no longer can steward. If you worship, you can't steward over the life. And our goal, I don't own my kids. I am a guide. I am here. I've sent to give them direction. And I'm not sent here to be their friend all the time, because most of the stuff, what I always realize in life, that everything that is good for you isn't easy. It doesn't taste good. All the food that's good for you rarely tastes good, right? All of the things that are good for you rarely feels good when you're doing it. So the thing is, it's easy in the beginning and hard in the end on certain things, and then it's hard in the beginning and makes it easy on the end. So what I believe is that we have to make it some level of hard for our kids in the beginning, so that it's easy on the back end. And I think it's the opposite. I think we do easy, and so we end up making it very, very difficult. And we have the high rate of suicide, the high rate of drug use, the high rate of lack of confidence and self-esteem and lack of drive, all predicated on what we talked about, the phone. And then also in the overcorrection of the harsh raising and rearing back in the day. It's an overcorrection where, no, you never should spank a child, or you never should scream at a child. Everything that happens in this life calls for different methods. Yeah. Sometimes you might scream, sometimes you may talk, sometimes you may feel where they are. That is your job, to kind of figure out what is right for the kid at that moment. It's not gonna always be perfect, but you can lead with love, and as long as you lead with love, at some point in time, I experienced it with my father, and that's why my father is my guy, you know, till we meet again, that's my guy, because he taught me some lessons that he could have, early on, he probably would have whooped them into me, but he showed them. He said, oh, okay, you want to waste my money, you want to waste time, okay. Hey, Doris, we won't buy him another thing. And he stood on business. If I wasted his stuff, he severed the resources. He only did what he was obligated to do as a father. Feed me, clothe me.
Yep.
And I talked about this before on the podcast. The clothing, we got $30 for shoes. Man, come on, Dad. Shit.
What am I going to buy with $30? Payless for real.
And this was, even back then, you could get some stuff for some Reeboks or something, maybe right around. But man, it was usually, I got to put $15, $20, $30 more dollars. He said, look, if it's not enough, this is the budget. You can add to it, or like Dave Chappelle, or you can shut the fuck up. So that's kind of his motto, even though he never cursed, but that was his motto.
Yeah.
It was just like, man, don't waste my money and time. And it taught me such a valuable lesson that I've actually used with my own kids, and the results have been great. You know, especially my oldest daughter, we tease all the time, but we had those moments, and we're super close now because of it. So,
no, that's amazing, man. I'm in that space with my daughter now. She's only six, but she's beyond her time with comprehension and wisdom and just understanding life. And she knows when and how to ask me for things, and she's getting smarter and smarter. Like, she'll have that, you know, she's six, so she's gonna whine and all that kind of stuff. And we're, you know, rearing that out of her. But also, she knows now when I tell her something, she's like, okay, Dad. And I'm like, oh, dang, she just listened. And then she'll wait an hour when we're doing something else. Like, okay, Daddy, if I finish my homework on time, then can I get a popsicle? You know what, you can.
Absolutely.
And she is learning.
To negotiate.
Yes.
Right.
And those moments of learning, they happen in every moment, and parents don't realize that.
But Todd, you know what you're teaching, bro? You really are teaching your child to understand that there is no freebies in life. You everything is based on performance, production. We love this talk about what, again, this is, for me, therapy speak. This is self-awareness speak. You know, what I deserve, what do you deserve? And this is a real question for anybody listening. What do you deserve? You deserve the benefits of what you produce or bring value for in order to deserve. You don't deserve just because you have life, right? Because you deserve to have the opportunities to create things for yourself, but you don't deserve for anyone to hand you anything. So she's understanding that now, that if I finish my homework, right, I have to give something. It's not just take.
Yeah.
So that's something that I think has, man, value, far-reaching value.
Oh, for sure.
In terms of your, and that's great that she's, you know, picking it up, man. Testament to y'all for the way you're raising them, for her to even think like that. I think that's huge.
No, absolutely. And I've learned from, I'm going to be real, I learned from all the mistakes that I've seen all these parents make throughout the years, where we had kids who come and think they deserve this opportunity to play basketball, to be developed by me. And I'm not saying that I'm like a great developer, but there are certain rules and regulations and criteria you're going to have to fit to get this work.
Absolutely, man. I like that.
And just those things that say, hey, and I say, like, I ain't your parents. And you could go tell them I said that. So we can have a discussion about how this is going to work while you're in my gym, because I'm not growing you to be a basketball player. I'm growing you to be a leader. And
a good person.
That's it. Like that character piece has to speak every single time. And that is where these trainers lose it. Too many man, I'd be doggone if I cussed in front of my coach growing up. Actually, I did. And you know what happened? I couldn't play basketball for 3 weeks. I got a whooping. I had to do all these things to even get back in the good graces to be on the team, to go sit on the bench for the rest of the season, because I was upset, emotional in the game, and I went off, said something terrible.
I think this is a great conversation. Because while I don't disagree with you, I love the fact that you have that rule. For me, I would rather a kid curse in front of me than to say yes, sir, and not be listening.
I like that too.
Right. So I
allow questions though. I like that. Mm-hmm. Mine's more about self-control, right?
Yep.
And that's why I teach no cussing, for that purpose. But the yes coach without listening. Whew,
yes sir. What did I just say? All right. Could you say it? Yeah, exactly. You don't have to. It shouldn't be on autopilot, right? When I say about the cursing, listen, I'm a little different because I always say, look, man. Do you remember training day when Denzel said you got to have a little dirt on you? Mm-hmm. Now, he had mud. That's different.
He was filthy.
But when kids, you know, you say, hey, yo, man, watch your mouth. But you didn't. You don't say that. Da, 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 da.
Oh, no. Mine's like this. They're like this. Like, mine is, they cuss, right? And I look at them crazy, and they're like, my bad, coach.
Exactly.
They acknowledge that. Oh, yo, exactly. My bad.
See, that's where, that's
now,
kinda where
I'm a kid at. Who was having a emotional outburst.
Yeah, that's different.
I'm on you. Now you're not controlling your mud. I just saw this post this morning. It was crazy. It said, you cannot allow your emotions to not let you take care of your responsibilities.
Absolutely.
That's the piece. It's like, man, you letting your emotions take you somewhere where you're not going to take care of your responsibilities on this court.
Yeah,
that's
a fact.
At the house if you are, you know. And so those little moments. I want to transition this because you wrote a book kind of about this,
yeah,
right?
That,
are you the reason your kid's not playing,
yeah,
right?
That, no, could you be the reason your kid is trash? Let's make sure we get this right.
Could you be the reason
your kid is trash?
Get it on Amazon. It has all 5-star reviews. It's real.
You know, 8 keys to maximizing. The tagline is the 8 keys to maximizing your young athlete's potential. So it's a question. It's not an indictment.
Right.
So the question is, could you be? And then trash is the vernacular. People can get bent out of shape, but that's what how we talk in basketball.
Oh, yeah, your kid's like, trash. I call kids trash on the daily,
team,
unfortunately.
Did y'all lose last night? My team was trash, man. We beat them.
Hey, man, you
could
recycle trash to turn to something else.
Absolutely. And so one of the things, it was really a book of do's and don'ts. And it really is a good, and I'm not just saying it because I wrote it. I think it's a great read. It's short, which I like. But it has actionable steps.
Yeah.
And also, after every chapter, it's a reflect and an action. So something to reflect on, right? And I talk about, you know, shielding athletes from all negative situations, right? You know, shielding them from all negative experiences. And I think we have a problem with that. It's like we want them to arrive again pristine, no dirt, no torn pants, no nothing. It's just you everywhere you go, it's got to be pristine. And now you wonder why can't, you know, we spend all this money on this Ivy League education and he wants to surf or he wants to do this. Like, what's going on with, no, because once it got a little rough and you didn't get the experience of coping with that whatever roughness early and figuring out ways to solve problems, you become adults who can't solve problems. Mm. And that's what that book was really about. The book was really about, okay, if you're going to do this, right, as a parent, are you enabling your kid? Are you really the reason? Can you look in the mirror and say, yeah, I know I let him get away with too much stuff? Or in this situation, I should have put my foot down. Or you know what? You can't go back on your word in this situation. Those are the things that I wanted that book to reveal within parents, right? Being politic proof was a chapter that was very, very important for me. Like, I've never heard a person complain about politics when it benefited them.
Hmm.
So do you hate the politics?
Man.
Or do you hate it when it's not in your favor?
Word.
And I want you to think about this from a big picture thing. You and I have some pretty decent access. we get floor seats to a game that people were camping out in tents outside. Mm-hmm. How many times have you said, no, no, that's wrong. Let me grab the tickets and I'm going to go out here and give the floor seats to someone who's in a tent.
Never, ever.
You're never going to do it, right? Right. So mm-hmm. that's what I mean by we everywhere in life is going to be politics. Now, what I say, though, is that how can you make yourself politics proof? By being prepared, by doing the things you're supposed to do, by being the best player you can possibly be, right? And now, if you're in a situation, I even talk about when you transfer in that book. You don't transfer because you haven't put in the work and you can't play. You transfer when you are good. You can play. Everybody knows you have the work ethic, you have the requisite skill, you have all of it. But there is a player there who might just be at the same position better than you right now. Mm-hmm. So you have to go somewhere else where you're able to grow. And in 2 years, y'all meet up, y'all might be the same or you might even be a little better. This happens all the time. But that has to be a real conversation. It can't just be a jump into that. No, I want to get out of here. He doesn't like me. Favoritism and da da da. No. Let's really evaluate it. How are you better than the person in front of you? Yeah. I talk about this in the book. How are you? Some arbitrary nonsense. Well, I can shoot better. Okay, how have you measured that? Is it on the Dr. Dish? Is it in practices? Is it when you get in games, the shot attempts you have, or your higher percentage? But are you rotating on defense? It's the shot making the issue, or is it your defense? Or are you a team player? Or do you know the plays? It's so many other factors, but you hear kids give these arbitrary answers that, yeah, I'm just better, I'm faster, I can shoot better, and I can dribble. And that doesn't mean you're a better player or a better player for the team. So that's the thing I wanted to convey. And one of the biggest things, I think, in the book, the entire book leads to you developing ironclad confidence in your kid. That's the word I use, ironclad confidence. And confidence is rooted in work. But right before that chapter, I talk about how you select player development coaches, speed and agility coaches, mental toughness coaches, how you broke it down when you looked at their methodology, you look at their experience. And what I always say, experience doesn't mean that somebody hasn't fallen off the wagon just last night. They could have a great track record and something could be going on with them right now. Experience isn't enough. It's experience while looking at what they're doing right now.
Right.
Right. And then being able to assess how much of that is the player is already good and how much is this them bringing out what's good in the player. See, these are real conversations. So you ask people, what's your methodology? How do you develop players? Then you ask, like, so who are some of the players? Tell me a little bit about them when they started. Were they already blue chippers? These are the real things. And I always suggest that, for me, it was always like, go spend money with other trainers. I've said this over and over again. I'd rather you go spend money with other trainers first, come to me last. Now you can assess. If you come to me first, you may believe that it's something else better out there.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm okay with too, if you go to someone else before you meet me and you have some connection with them and it works, I'm okay with that. It's right. Not, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can't lose what you never had. For me, I just think that's the best way because you'll start to see the differences. And I think for anybody who's listening and trying to decide who you go with as a player development coach, I think it'll be good to spend money with 4 or 5 trainers, one session, kind of see what the deal is. And then kind of make your decision. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever.
No, I think those are some great guidelines and even deeper than what I think, right? I try to simplify things for parents, right?
Yep.
And tell them the things that you look for in trainers that you should immediately say no to.
Yeah.
The red flag type stuff. But that is... that stuff matters so much. Your circle, the people that you're around. We touched on it earlier, but because I want to jump back into it and like the parents being on the same page about it, right? All that
stuff,
the inner circle, and I call it the board of directors, those people who are helping guide you as Todd Wilson, the basketball business, yeah, to my goal, or Todd Wilson, the person who plays basketball, to my goal, is so important. What tools would you give, or would you, yeah, what advice do you have for those people in co-parenting situations who seem like they cannot get on the same page about their kids' development and the little things?
Honestly, man, the only thing you can say is you got to grow up. You got to grow up. You know, this is bigger than you. This is the future, right? This is the future, not just your future legacy. It's the future, right?
Yeah. You know,
it's funny. I think when they said that youth represent only 30% of the population or something. I forgot what it was, 30% of the population, but 100% of the future. Mm. Think about that for a second. This is the future. This is, yeah, going to be our leaders. These are going to be our teachers. And we can't leave them at a disadvantage because we can't figure it out, right?
Right.
It should be what's in the best interest, not what's in the best feeling of the kid. And this is where I think from a gender standpoint, sometimes we fall short. And I think it's a natural balance. It's supposed to be a natural balance. I know you can run to your mom, right? As you should. But it should be run to your mom for maybe some short-term comfort, but no long-term decision-making to veer you off of the course that we know you should be on, like quitting situations that you committed to. All of those things, I think, are detrimental to a kid. And no matter how you cater to feelings, I've said it before, you've heard me say it, the world gives zero F's about your feelings. They just don't. Nothing you can do that can make the world care about you. You know who people care about? They care about themselves, right? The world cares about productivity, not feelings. You have to produce in this life. And when I say it, even when you talk about areas of life that you feel like you don't produce in, this is not a capitalistic, you know, area, like activism. If Martin Luther King doesn't have anybody following him, mm-hmm, how good of an activist is he really? Mm. Yeah. You got to produce. You got to get followers. You got to, yeah, people to buy, get to come to the rallies and buy into your cause.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying about productivity, every aspect. If you're a pastor with one person in the church, you ain't producing.
Sorry, I had a personal experience with that, so I had to laugh for a second.
So you gotta think about that.
No,
so.
I just to piggyback on what you're saying, man, we are here for a purpose.
Absolutely.
A God-given purpose who gave us a gift to share with the world. And if we're not sharing that, if we're not seeking God on what that gift is and knowing how to share that with the world, then we're always going to be lost. We won't have any followers until we really, truly understand what being fruitful and replenishing is. Is that,
absolutely,
that fruit, the seed that's from within inside, spreading the earth to create more of it. And that's that productivity that you're talking about, man, always, you know, this is who I am, man. It always draws back to the original purpose that God put us here. And that's it. It's sharing that.
Absolutely.
And your growth, you grow exponentially when you do that. It multiplies. Yep. It don't just add. It multiplies
man,
in that way.
And that's why I think I've been blessed in my life. No matter how bleak any situation has seemed, I've been blessed because with mistakes, my heart has always been in the right place, right? But I'm human. We're flesh. We make decisions that are bad decisions. We make hasty decisions. We, even as men, we make emotional decisions at times, but at the end of the day, we got to be able to rise above it and, first of all, acknowledge it, because I think that's a big issue in life. People don't acknowledge when they do those things. It's always an excuse. It was a reason someone made you do it. Nah, you did it. You did it. You actually did it. No one made you do it, right? No one forced you to do it. No one even encouraged you to do it. You did it. And once you start to take that level of accountability, I think you can move forward. And I think with kids, there is, again, it's a the title to me has always been steward. I'm a steward over the lives of my kids. I'm, again, don't own them. I don't control them. They're not me. When I say control them, meaning they're not just pieces that I move around on a board. They're people that I have conversations with. I take into consideration maybe some of the feelings in a sense, not to accept them, but to be able to speak to those feelings and tell you what those feelings are versus allowing someone who is 15 or 14 or 13 or 11 make decisions for themselves because of their feelings. You would eat pizza and peanut butter all day long if the kid made the decision.
Right?
You would never, when would a kid drink water? Man, it would be juice and popping, but it would always be soda. Something. Yeah, all the time. So man, that's my thing, man. I think you're spot on in terms of like I said, that separation amongst parents. And I think it really boils down to this internal conflict they had with their own upbringing and this internal conflict that they have with being loved and liked by their kids. I didn't like my daddy and mama until later. And I love my, it's not a day that goes by that I wish I couldn't just say again to my dad, man, how much, man, you just impacted me, just your integrity, the way you live, the lessons you taught me by taking things away, not giving me certain things. He gave me a lot early. And once I showed my hand that I wasn't going to respect it or appreciate it, he removed it. And what is wrong with that? Oh, that's harsh. That's mean. You shouldn't do that to kids. They're just kids or whatever, man.
That's real love. I think that's what it is. People mistake that for love. Real love has discipline in it. Real
Absolute
love has
commitment.
Man.
Dedication.
And that we need to research what love is. And like you said, it comes from that upbringing. Man, it's a good book called How We Love that discusses that. How you were loved when you were younger and how it reflects in your adulthood. And it's for couples who are about to get married or being married. We use it for premarital counseling, my wife and I.
Yeah.
And it literally speaks to that. It puts a label on
that. So I can
come
to you when I get married.
I've married 9 people. Man. Most of them are people in the basketball world.
What if I had like 4 wives? Could you?
Like separately, that many times? Our premarital counseling didn't work, so I probably would have said no to all of them. And pray for you, brother.
No,
pray
I'm
for
I'm
you.
Saying,
might need to be
joking.
A monk I'm or something joking. And stay
I'm
away.
I'm
he
joking.
Said, 4 wives. We ain't moving. Never mind. But yes, how we love, man, is super important. And understanding that, and it changed me reading that book. It was the most impactful book of my marriage. Me and my wife get along very well. It was super impactful because we had to see each other as we were when we were from 0 to 15.
Yeah.
And like, oh, that's why you can't make a decision.
Absolutely.
That's why you don't stop moving for me, right? And now we have a level of understanding, and those things aren't ever gonna change. But we have a compromise now on how we're going to discuss this and work through this in our relationship.
Let me tell you the most powerful moment of my life. And again, I have to give it up to my dad because my dad facilitated this. So I had and I hate to use this as some, it's not a tumultuous relationship with my mom. I just had a kind of combative relationship with my mom growing up. And one day I used to always ask my dad a bunch of questions. And I just asked him some silly ass question like, man, how was it like growing up poor? So it was like something like, my dad was like, man, son, I don't even think I would consider us poor. We always had clean clothes. We always had the lights on. You know, we always had something to eat. My dad was working. I wouldn't consider us poor. And then he paused for a second. He said, but your mom, son, she had it. And I thought about it and I said, okay. He said, man, when her dad died, because her dad died when he was 44 years old. She was 16. So my grandmother, rest her soul, was really distraught, was, for lack of a better term, went through a breakdown for a few years after his death because she had 5 kids. And so my mom, the oldest, had to take care of 4 other brothers and sisters and her mom. So when does she have time to coddle and love and hug. She was thrust into adulthood at 16 years old. And it shaped a lot of her life, like the fear in certain aspects of her life. It shaped a lot. So maybe, just maybe, when, you know, I was ungrateful, right? Or maybe because, and she's even said it post my dad's death that, man, your dad just, she just get on my nerves with you. He carried you around till your legs was as long as his. And he would say, take Fran and Junior to church and I'll take Dorian. And that used to burn me up while but maybe it was that attention from the father that she kind of missed out in some really crucial times in her life. 16, going into womanhood, like really going into womanhood and going off to college, that maybe my dad represented, and now it seemed to be a little competition for that, you know, affection or attention or whatever. And I don't think any of that stuff is conscious. I think it's just unconscious. Just like you said, from
where you're wired,
zero
man.
To 16, bro. Tell me, man, that's my mom. And then it changed the way I looked at my mom forever. My mom was like, damn, my mom is she's tough. Where they had nights where they slept, where they had to cuddle up in the house where you could see the grass under the house, the gap in the floors were that big. It was that cold.
Dang.
And so, and you have a master's, you become a respected, one of the most respected educators in our hometown. Like literally, when I was acted up, man, they respected my parents so much. I got out of more stuff, even though I got in trouble. They were like, man, I ought to tear you up, but because of Doris and Frank, I'm just gonna call them. And I'd be like, no, tear me up. Please don't call them. Just tear me up. I won't say anything. Just whoop me. No. This was the time back then. I don't know if you grew up in that era, that you wanted to get paddled.
Mm.
That was, the community was so tight then. If you got, just say someone in the neighborhood spanked you, and your mom found out.
You getting spanked again.
Like, why did he have to spank you? It was not like, why are you touching my child? It was none of that, because it was a trust in the community. And I love that. And all my boys are like this, even with my kids. We can, for lack of a better term, not literally yoke them up, but you can yoke our kids up. My nephew, these are good friends, my nephews. I can, hey man, hey bro, what you doing? Stop doing that.
Yes.
You know better than that. And it's no like, man, don't talk to my kid like that. It's a understood, it's an ecosystem.
Yes.
And with that, you start to see how kids move differently when they know they got
accountability, man.
Checks and balances across the board, man. Like, I can't get away from the checks and balances. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But when you have a chink in the armor and you have a place where people can go for refuge when it really is enabling, it really affects the kid long term.
Yeah.
So,
man, thank you.
I appreciate
thank
you,
man.
Bro.
Amazing insight, man. Your journey is amazing, and how your trauma allowed you to get to where you at.
Yeah, yeah.
Your trauma, right? I say it like that,
obstacles.
But hey, and obstacles. Yeah, and you know, people view things a certain way, and so I do want to say this because you mentioned it, and as I always see this on things, it's just like, hey, if you are struggling with any, you know, suicidal thoughts, addiction, trauma in your life, or things that are happening in your life that you feel are out of your control, reach out to somebody, reach out to me, hit us up. That stuff is important to have someone there for you during those times.
And
you're not
so
alone.
And so you can reframe what's happening. Sometimes it's not even... Again, man, and I said this over and over again, I think the comparison game is the root of all insecurity and hurt and pain and despair. It's because you believe deep down you're supposed to be somewhere that, number one, you're not prepared for. You would be there.
Mm.
If you're not there, you're still in the stages of preparation. So most often you see most of that come from just pure envy, meaning I want to be that. Why can't I be that? But you don't know, number one, if that is real and what they did to get there, good or bad.
Mm.
The work they did, the shortcuts they took,
right?
the illegal activity they did. Like, you never know. Right. But you'll compare yourself to what you believe is a finished product, and you have angst and anxiety about, man, why am I just not doing what I'm supposed to do? No, you're where you're supposed to be until you learn what lesson you need to learn.
100%. So this is the final buzzer, all right? I have one question for you. If you had a billboard that every young athlete would see and it spoke one truth, what would that billboard say?
And this is, no one cares. You have to care about you. No one cares. Once you realize truly that no one's coming to save you, that's when you start to become free. And you have to accept in this life, right, that nobody cares, right? We're just passing through anyway. You're going to be replaced at some point in time. So if you understand that everything's replaceable, everything is going to change, change is inevitable, you start to get that no one cares, right? Just get it done. And if you can have that mindset, I really believe it changes your life by just living by that mantra.
I love it. I love it. I'm thrown off by it a little bit. I'm thrown off by it. I gotta really think about that one before I even respond to it, because that's good. I want to say this, and help me here, because no one cares feels isolated. You feel alone, but I always want people to know that, hey, God is there for you, one.
Yep.
Right? And there is resources you can go to, even if no one cares, to get you where you want to be. Are those truths inside of that?
I will say this, and this is to clear it up. The actual world doesn't care. You will have a few people who care, but they can't save you, per se, from the world. And even though, and I've said it all the time, if you got a mom, every mom thinks they baby the cutest, them ugly little babies. And mama think, my baby's so cool. Mama, look at that baby look like a little baby ostrich. And you over here talking about you cute. But to you, because of the way the body is designed, it really does look like the most beautiful thing in the world. Man, my baby, my youngest, used to look like Don Rickles growing up. And I was like, damn, but look just like, I put up a meme with Don Rickles next to him. And I was like, you see what I'm talking about? Everybody was laughing. But they were beautiful to me.
Yeah.
All my kids as babies, and I look back, they were funny looking, but they were beautiful to me.
Yeah.
But that's the way the brain works, and it's designed so you don't eat your young, right?
Right.
It's an evolutionary construct. So for me, I'm always thinking, like, yes, your mom cares a little bit. Yes, your mom cares. But to what extent? How far will she go if you're not productive in life? You know what I'm saying? So those are the things. So, yes, it's some people who care. And it feels isolated, because the truth is, we really, man, I know this sounds silly, but I do think we are, in a sense, because of our ability to produce, and especially, and again, not to make this a gender thing, but men, that's why you see the majority of homeless, the majority of suicides, the majority of depression. The numbers for men are through the roof, because we really, the world doesn't view us at times as humans. There's no humanity with being a man. Even if you're going through a period where it's tough, it's like, man, you're healthy, Todd. Why can't you just get up and go get a job and do this? They don't, you can't have a season, a moment, right? So once you, I think the liberating fact is, once you realize it, is that, you know what, man? Because remember, we act out sometimes so we can get that response. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get you to understand that just go within. That's the God we talk about. God is within. We have to go within. That's the meditation. That's the prayer. We go within, right, to change our world without. So that's kind of, hopefully that made sense, but
no,
I hate to be, it's not meant to be an indictment. Like you, it's just this the cold world. I don't even look at it like that. I look at it as, this is just what it is.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right?
And I seen that. And I love the clarity now, because people are literal. And so I want them to, the philosophical side of you. You know, this is why we work out together, is because you say some deep stuff and I can organize it.
So
there's a last one. We flip the script.
All right.
One question for me about anything in the world.
Because you're a man of many talents. So when I say many talents, what's next for you? And if you can't say it, I'm cool.
No,
you know, we can talk
absolutely
about
that. I can. It's a season of focus, man. I've cut off all the extra fat in my life. Anything that I said yes to because I'm a nice person and my heart is always to help people, I've cut it off. I've literally said no. I've literally broken up with people. Not like my wife or anything.
Yeah,
me and my wife are happily married
12
years.
Bro.
I love you, babe. and I know what God has called me to do. And I'm on that mission to fulfill it through the avenues that are right in front of me, which is my business / ministry with Core Prep, my consulting, and being
a resource.
Stop being in the background of everything.
Absolutely.
It's time to come out front and visually be a leader in a space where if I don't have it, somebody I know has the resource to help somebody, and that's my call, is to just take people from where they are and help them to become who they're supposed to become, if that makes sense.
That's
and so
good,
got a working on a book, and people will start hearing about it actually right now, maybe. I got a book that should be coming out definitely by the end of this year.
On steroids. So you got to
hopefully I get the same reviews. It's a guide to help families and through this basketball journey, and man, we've got, you know, other stuff that we talked about.
I'm gonna give you your first 5-star.
Appreciate you, brother.
I'm gonna give you your first 5-star, man. Now I'm proud of you, man. So we got some stuff that we cook it. So it's gonna be good, man. I'm excited about it. I think we got some stuff that changes this landscape again through education and through commitment and diligence and expressing that, conveying that to the other people out there who need to know it. This is not going to be a shortcut. We want to give you the tools that make you, again, not just a good basketball player, not just a person who is worthy of NIL, right? Because that's when people don't understand, to get those things, you have to.
You about to start a whole new podcast, boy.
Become something. You follow me? So that's what
become.
I'm talking about. That's what I'm excited about, what we're doing.
So. No, absolutely, man. Absolutely, man. My brother, appreciate you.
Love you, man.
Love you too, man. Thank you guys for tuning in, man. Welcome to season 3. I hope you guys love our new format. Just so you guys know where we've been, been doing a lot of traveling and consulting and developing to help bring you new friends and family onto the show and bring you things that are going to help you along your journey and of life through this game of basketball. So we appreciate you, and we'll see you next time. Peace.